Hello and welcome to the Double Pivot, the world's most agreeable soccer analytics podcast. I am Michael Cayley, and I would like to begin with some reflections, sort of get us started on what I think of as the task of the intellectual. So, in various guises in my career, I have sort of spent time writing, thinking, analyzing. This is what I have done as an academic, as a soccer writer. It's kind of not entirely what I do as an organizer, so that's fun. But, like, and one thing that I think is sort of like a trend you see in a lot of sort of philosophy of what it is to be intellectual, what it is to be a public intellectual, is that it is not your job in moments of real clashes where like real political things are at stake. It's not your job to like suddenly go out there and say, no, this is the way we should all be doing things. The job of the intellectual is to reflect on what is being done in the streets, help explain it, help it gain coherence, and also be informed yourself and allow yourself to sort of see the new possibilities that are created by those actions. And so that's what this podcast is. Me and Mike are here to talk about fan protest in soccer, what it's about, and all of that. Joined by Mike Goodman, ready to perform the crucial task of the intellectual?
I am ready to perform the crucial task of the intellectual. I frequently say I am busy performing the crucial task of the intellectual when I'm supposed to be doing things like dishes or parenting. The music you heard on the way in is The Wailers. Max is not with us on the other side of the virtual glass. Please download, subscribe, make us happy as podcasters. Subscribe to patreon.com/doublepivot, where this week we will be talking about Champions League come what may. But yeah, there's been like a lot of stuff bubbling under that then bubbled over at Manchester United and Old Trafford, I guess is a good way to look at it. We were maybe going to talk about this anyway because Arsenal have been sort of protesting, and there have been not active protests, but there have been some contentious like meetings of fan stakeholders where they are demanding that the Kroenkes sell the club, and the Kroenkes are not interested in selling the club, and a man named Ek, who is a partial owner of Spotify, who made his billions in Spotify and is apparently an Arsenal fan from youth, has gathered up a couple of old Arsenal legends and said, I'd like to buy the club. So that was already happening when Sunday occurred. And on Sunday, we had a full-on protest, which sort of tipped over to the uglier side of protest, which is still protest. And we can talk about all of this stuff.
Yep, and, like, this is all clearly, like, this is all stuff that has been, you know, resentments, concerns, worries, anger that have been part of English football fandom for a while. And you have this big moment of the formation of the Super League, and I think we talked about this, like, kind of incredible amount of fan solidarity against the Super League. Where, like, you know, this was not a given. I think there's been some reporting in Spain in particular on how a lot of Barcelona fans, like, did not feel solidarity with Cadiz fans
right
in opposing a Super League.
Yeah, Barcelona and Real Madrid are just, they are much more as entities, some detached from La Liga. For a number of reasons.
Yeah, and so, like, I don't think it was a given that this would be the response in England, but it was. It was cool. And so there's like a lot of anger at the owners who attempted to pull this off that got, I think, in a lot of ways stitched onto existing anger about these ownership groups, which is not necessarily about the Super League. And so you had protests at a number of clubs. There were protests outside the Tottenham Stadium, outside of Stamford Bridge, like, in Liverpool, like, there have been people who were mad, but nothing nearly the scale or effectiveness of what we saw at Old Trafford this weekend. I think that's a really important point, because what's going on here at Old Trafford is both the anger of United fans at the Super League and at this sort of the general way that reflected, I think, an ownership that isn't listening. An ownership whose values are, you know, to make money even when this offended the sensibilities of the fans. At the same time, you also have an ownership group that has not been spending money well. They haven't been spending very much money, and what they have done, they haven't done it well. So you have a club that is an absolute economic behemoth, easily should be winning or competing for titles, and has not competed for a title, in years and years and years. So you have anger at the, like, way that the club is being run, which isn't, like, totally separate from the fact that the club is being that the Glazers are not listening to the fans on other issues. Like, these are related things. These are not absolutely separate. But I think that, like, the fact that this protest boiled over at Manchester United shows us something really important about what this fan protest movement is and the sort of two, in many ways, competing parts of it around the success of a football team on the field and the effectiveness of the management team at putting forward a football team that competes on the field, and the anger of fans at the way in which their club is run autocratically without real, like, engagement with the stakeholders. These are two distinguishable things that come together.
I think a good place to start is the sort of the intersection of all of these issues with performance on the field, because of the fact that so often something that is argued is basically like, you say you are bothered by all of these things, but if you were just winning, you would not be bothered by all of these things. So really, what are you bothered by? And I think that there is a kernel of something there, where it is true that fans will be more willing to forgive things that they do not like if you are providing them with something that they do like. You know, it's like, you can accept a deal with the devil if the devil is delivering on his end of the bargain, right? But I think it's important to understand that fans are self-aware that that is what's happening, right? Like, they are aware that this is a deal they are making with the devil, and that they don't really have a choice about it. And that, yes, if in exchange for that you end up winning, well, you get mollified to some degree. But if you look at, say, Arsenal, you know, the success at Arsenal is that they have turned themselves into a profitable club that is well run, that can invest in players while still turning a, you know, if not a profit, at least running even, while the value of the club has increased tremendously. Well, all of those things are not what fans are in it for. Fans are in it to win. And you might, you know, and like, yes, I think fans would like for their clubs to be stable and you know, run decently, but not at the expense of winning, because, like, the point of rooting for a football team is to win. And so I do think it is worth both acknowledging the truth of the fact that winning papers over these ills, while also acknowledging that it doesn't erase them, that it doesn't make these things that fans don't like about modern football go away, that the situation we find themselves in contains things that make fans unhappy, certain fans, unhappy with where the game is, and while they will overlook that if you're winning, that doesn't mean that the not winning is the only thing that is bothering them, that they are protesting against.
Right, the fact that it's happening now after the Super League, you can't just wave that away.
Right, you can also say that the protests have been much more intense at Arsenal and Manchester United, the two teams that have underperformed for the past 5 years, than they were at Liverpool.
Exactly, it's crucially both and.
Right, exactly.
I think that one thing I would say to the, like, fans want to win, fans also want to be a part of an acknowledged community.
And I think this is something that is pretty crucially different from American sports in terms of the relationship, which is that it's not so much that, you know, it's not so much that fans and owners have a different material relationship on this side of the Atlantic and in the UK and Britain and really for parts of Europe anyway. But when you trace sort of the lineage of how these sports were run, the bond between ownership and fans was something that was acknowledged by owners as a norm for a long time, even after it ceased to be a material relationship. This was just, if you were to be an owner, like, and I mean, I don't mean to snark here, but like, you had to pay lip service to this, right? Like, you had to make fans feel important in the management of the club, even if you were no longer listening to them. And really, like, for a long time, owners have not been listening to fans in any meaningful way. But they did, while not doing that, go out of their way to make them feel as if they were part of this process. You know, it's like a very typical norms discussion here. And then you do have a generation of not English owners, specifically in the Premier League, who come in, recognize the lack of a material relationship here between ownership and fans, and have no sense of how to maintain the norms so that fans are not bothered by this lack of material relationship. And this is not, I mean, this is, yes, it is American owners, but it is certainly not just American owners in this way. And the better ownership groups, like, again, they figure out a way to understand this. Like, Roman Abramovich at Chelsea eventually figured out how to build bonds with the fans. FSG has, after a really rocky start, kind of did an okay job with that. And again, winning helps. But, like, did an okay job at it. Spurs have been uneven, but, like, better than Arsenal, better than Manchester United, who have just not done it at all. And I want to emphasize, like, Mike Ashley doesn't do it at all either, right? Like, there are bad native owners for sure. Manchester City doesn't do it, like, basically at all. So, like, there's a broad spectrum here, like, across the board.
Yeah, and so, like, and I think that the American thing is important. One thing I've been, that struck me watching this is that, like, I think a lot of what these American owners, like, expect is an experience that they have had owning teams in America.
Right.
Which is that fans might say they don't like something, but they won't do anything about it.
Yeah.
And even when they have tried to do something about it, like, fans, I mean, the sort of paradigmatic sort of, I think, experiences of American fandom around this, you have, like, way back in the day, you have the Dodgers and the Giants leaving New York, the baseball teams, and going to L.A. and San Francisco, and, you know, famously the Dodgers, like, in the dead of night, just didn't tell their fans and left. And, like, this sort of sets a core precedent that owners can just do that and no one can do anything about it. And then you have the move of the Seattle Supersonics NBA team to Oklahoma City over, like, quite significant fan protest.
Yeah, there's only one real counter exception here, and it's recent, and it's the Columbus Crew in MLS, yeah, who fan protest really did save that club in Columbus. But it is the absolute rarity. And again, yeah, it's because, like, when fans are doing this protest in America, they are doing it against the norm, which is that owners own the teams. And, you know, fans are customers, and there are other customers in other cities.
And it comes only at these moments of, like, it is much, much bigger deal that, like, the Seattle Supersonics no longer exist and basketball fans in Seattle don't have an NBA team, right, than Manchester United, like, tried to join the Super League or, you know,
finish third.
Like, the moments that you have, like, actual fan organizing in the U.S. are at moments of extremity that basically are, like, impossible to think of for the most part in British sport. Like, people still talk about Wimbledon and MK Dons.
The Super League is pretty close, right? And what we, and I think the Super League is the closest thing that we've gotten in European football to those moments of crisis in American sports where teams up and leave. And what did we saw? We saw unprecedented solidarity from fans in that moment. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that, like, a lot of, like, American responses, it is really weird if you grew up watching sports basically only in the U.S. to see fans protesting like this. It is just like not how things are done. Not that it's bad or not necessarily that it's amazingly good, but like I think that a lot of Americans watching this, you have to sort of like, okay, this is a culturally different thing that is happening.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is 100% right. The next thing I'd say is that if you were unaware of any of this and were just following it through British media, you would not really receive the message that this is like a normal, okay. I want to bracket something specifically, because there are going to be people who object to like the destruction of property and the breaking onto the field that happened at Manchester United. And I kind of want to bracket that part of the conversation a little bit, because I think that getting bogged down in, you know, what is appropriate protest, what is inappropriate protest, how do we cross the line, how do we not cross the line, I think that is a discussion we can have, but I don't think it's particularly productive to what we're talking about in this specific moment. But, so let's put that aside and say that in general, if you were to follow fan protest through British media, I don't actually think you would get the sense that this was okay, normal, accepted, even though it has been a part of British sports, of soccer specifically, for, you know, like 100 years. And I think it's worth just sort of like kind of briefly like walking through why that is, which is basically that, you know, it is not really the case anymore that soccer in England is a working class sport and journalists are middle class journalists covering a working class sport. I do not want to present that as the current state of affairs. What I do want to say is that the tracks that we are on now, where we are on now, are tracks that came from that arrangement. In the worst moments of English football, when it really was sort of this, you know, closer to this caricature of violence and not on safety and, you know, sort of the worst moments of the 70s and the early 80s, when it was then demonized by a national press in very real ways. You had this dynamic, this political dynamic of players and fans who were largely working class being covered and reported on by an apparatus that was almost exclusively middle class. That is the roots of media coverage of soccer in the UK. And, like, those roots, you know, they have long tails. History has long tails. And those long tails can persist into today's coverage, I think.
This is, I mean, you get trained by the person who worked in your job before you. Like, you learn the ways that people around you think about things. It was striking to me, in particular, that it was ex-players who pushed back against the media narrative in British media for the most part. It was people who did not come up through the media apparatus. I mean, it was, you know, Gary Neville and Jamie Carragher most notably, but several, a bunch of other ex-players acknowledging the legitimacy of this protest and pushing back against the idea that it was some sort of, like, you know, violent horror show.
You know, I mean, we interviewed Peter Schmeichel, which is complicated because Peter Schmeichel is on the one hand a commentator and colleague of ours at CBS Sports, and on the other hand also employed by Manchester United as a brand ambassador. And like, I give him a lot of credit for being willing to talk in this spot, because he didn't have to, and it's not an easy position for him to be in. And he was somewhat defensive of the Glazers, thinking that they are claiming that they are improving as owners and they get it more now than they did. But he also, I mean, he was also quite, candid that he understands where these fans are coming from. And that when you make mistakes and invest but don't invest well, that these things will bother fans, and fans have a right to express their bother at these things. The flip side of what was striking to me was, to some degree, American coverage just sort of aped the tone of British coverage in a lot of ways. And where you can, understand but not excuse the British film, like where it's coming from in this coverage. Like, it seemed to me that a lot of the American coverage was just sort of like looking at it and copying it for no good reason. And that's not great to me. Like, that's just like, you can do more of your own critical analysis of what's going on. No, like, I get it. We're weirdos, me and you, right? Like, we enjoy doing this. Most people on a sports broadcast just want to talk about who's crossing the ball. Not because they are incapable of doing more, but because of, like, this is the profession that they have chosen to do and the thing that they want to do and enjoy doing. And then they get a different thing plopped in their lap. It's not easy to do live TV. It's not easy to write in these moments. But I do think that you can, like, want more than just sort of looking at how the British do it and then doing it that way as well for no reason beyond that's what they're doing.
Yeah. And on top of that, I would also say that, like, we are hopefully maybe going to see more fan activism. It's an interesting question. And I mean, I think we can open the question of whether we're likely what it would look like. But I think an important point here on the media critique side is that a reason to say the media should have done better this time, and like, okay, maybe you were all caught off guard. I was caught off guard by it. It was weird. But like, next time, like, understand the history.
Right.
Next time, like, address objectively the question of whether a guy leaving his shoe on the field at Old Trafford and then going back and getting his shoe from the steward is like something that needs to be talked about in somewhat horrified tones. Like,
yeah,
I think that like this can be done better and we can expect better from the coverage.
Yeah, I mean, I also think that like the issue I bracketed before, at least when we're talking about American coverage, has kind of been on everybody's mind for the past 6 months to a year. Like, how do you talk about protest has been a major point of American news contention, even as it hasn't related to sports, like, literally at all. But, like, you know, I don't think the question of how do you address protests in a fair way while also understanding what your beliefs are about what is inappropriate to do. And people will differ on that level, right? Like, there is a natural and correct suspicion when people start saying, like, I agree with what they're doing, but this is the wrong way to do it, which is something that people say all the time. You know, there is a natural suspicion that, like, well, you think any way to do it is the wrong way to do it. And, like, I think that is a fair and justified suspicion. But I think that, like, when you are caught off guard, that's just a very easy thing to say, right? Because it is a thing that both that sort of inoculates you from both sides of the issue. It is also true, I imagine, that there are people who would say, I am fine with, like, loud, boisterous protests outside the stadium, but you can't break in. Like, once you've broken in, you have crossed a personal line for me. I do not think you should do that. And, like, I don't think it's that big a deal for the most part. If somebody else does, like, it's, I don't think it is worth arguing about in the face of arguing about the bigger issues. But if you're going to be somebody who covers it, you need to, like, be able to authentically put yourself in a place where you understand what you think is okay and what you don't think is okay, right? Like, you can't express, I mean, you can do whatever you want. It is ineffective to express condemnation at some tactics if you don't have going in an understanding of the tactics that you think are okay and why you differ where you do. Even if those don't get, like, expressed, if we're just talking about, like, learning from last time and like, preparing possibly to cover protest, you need to have this sort of sorted out with yourself, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, this is sort of the joke of the, like, task of the intellectual. Like,
right.
Something new is happening in front of you. Like, That is exciting. That is an opportunity to figure out what it is and describe it and work through it and, like, not spending all of this mental energy and emotional energy and, like, time in front of a camera trying to figure out where your line is when you could be, like, explain to people what's going on in this exciting moment, I think is a missed opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I think that, unfortunately, that's, like, sort of what everybody does, because, like, being on TV is a high wire act, man. Like, you don't want to be the person who, like, accidentally says the thing that is going to get interpreted in a way that gets you in trouble. Like, and to a certain extent, like, everybody lives this on Twitter now, but it's magnified on TV. It really is. And so, I think that, like, yes, reporting on this stuff, you just sort of, like, play it straight, and this is what happens. But if you watch this coverage, they're not being asked to play it straight and report it, right? Like, they're being asked to pass judgments. Like, because it is the form of commentary that you are stuck with. If you're a studio show, they throw it to you, and you pass judgments. Whether it is, you know, on the structure of the defense, or whether the protests at Manchester United went too far. And this, again, I want to stress, is, like, I don't think it's anybody's fault, right? Like, everybody top to bottom putting these shows together makes a show that does this thing. That's what it does. It's what it's supposed to do. And you can't, like, it is exceptionally difficult in the moment to change the structure of how you are talking about things. So if you're going to be stuck having to pass judgments, you need to come in with an understanding of what your judgments are.
Yeah. So one thing I wanted to sort of come back around to is the point about the power dynamic, which I think is a really important point here.
Yeah.
And this is where US and UK sports converge. There's a big divergence in terms of sort of the sets of practices that relate to this power imbalance, but the power imbalance in itself is basically the same, which is that if you own a sports team, no one can really make you do anything about, like, what the fans think.
Well, in
a way of putting it specifically is that there is no structure by which you have accountability to the fans that you have not provisionally created yourself and could take away.
Right, that is right.
It is an autocratic system.
So now, Donald Sterling was forced to sell the Los Angeles Clippers. But Donald Sterling was forced to sell the Los Angeles Clippers basically because all the other owners agreed that it was very, very bad for Donald Sterling to own the Clippers. And so the mechanism by which this happens is the league, with the commissioner, forced this change. But the commissioner is, like, directly hired by the owners. So, like, there is an illusion of power here. That Donald Sterling, I mean, Donald Sterling had something taken away from him. And to a certain extent, it is because the owners all looked around and thought, this guy is toxic. The fans will, you know, the fans hate this. It is not okay for us to keep him around, in part because of the anticipated fan response to him. But it is a collective decision by ownership still.
In the case of the LA Clippers and their, you know, horrible racist owner, fans were going to in some way organize against him. What they were not going to do was take part in, like,
right,
a fan forum that is structurally part of the Los Angeles Clippers,
right,
by which they can express their displeasure. This is an autocratic system. What they could do is some forms of direct action, which scared the other owners enough, and the other owners already did not care for Donald Sterling and didn't really like the fact that he was a huge racist. And so these things came together. And so what you have at Old Trafford is us fans engaging in some direct actions to try to force the Glazers to put forward some, either just, like, make it not fun for them to own the team and they want to get out, or force them to at least put in some sort of provisional system of accountability. Like, what you have, you know, the sort of the ways that supporters groups at times meet with management and share their concerns. And this provides at least a provisional forum for the, for this. And they, you know, and then they can see if they get responses. But again, like the best that people are hoping for is that sort of provisional accountability within a fundamentally autocratic system, which is like a tough place to be.
When you look at what's going on at United, though, this comes back to like kind of where we opened the show, which is like they are trying to force the Glazers to do something. Glazers really don't care if people don't like them. Like, they really don't, right? Like, they're part of their being, part of the complaint of there being no connection between the Glazers and the fans is the fact that when the fans get dissatisfied, the Glazers don't care. But what is the easiest thing to do if you were the Glazers to try to make the fans like you more? Or at least accept their dislike from you and stop, you know, lighting off smoke bombs outside your stadium? Well, the answer is just kind of like spend some money on players and put together a better team and maybe win a trophy or two. Like, that is the absolute path of least resistance for the Glazers at this point. And something that I would not be surprised at all if they do. Like, I expect that they will do that, right? And so given that, you do then have this dynamic of, like, fans protest, owner spends, fans stop protesting. And it feeds into the cynical idea of, well, you're just unhappy that you're not winning. Where what is really going on, there is this more complicated dynamic that just ends up feeding into that loop. And I do think that that's instructive when we then go sort of talk about Arsenal and Kroenke and Ek. Because what you have is protests over Kroenke because they don't like Stan Kroenke and Kroenke Sports Enterprises or whatever the acronym is. And they want something else, but the only thing kind of available is like, well, I hope the next guy is a better version of Kroenke. And there is no path, like the easiest, like there is no path without massive reforms to get anything other than that.
You know, it's I think the thing that is sort of sitting there is the German system,
right,
where there is like mandated. And with, you know, there are loopholes. The 51% public ownership has, you know,
eroded.
They also don't like, they have not acted to restrain Bayern. The system is not in any way foolproof. It does not in any way like naturally and immediately produce the best soccer possible. But it does have accountability built into it, and which doesn't require, you know, storming the field.
Like, it formalizes into a power structure the norms that had been present in England, I think is the sort of the best way to think through it.
Exactly. And so, like, maintaining that accountability, maintaining that structure takes ongoing work. You need to organize fans to do things with it. Like, it doesn't solve things, but it produces the structure that doesn't exist in England.
It certainly leads to its own sort of eccentricities and, like, old money versus new money tensions and sort of, like, you know, there's a lot of... Anyway, that energy can get diverted in some weird ways thanks to all of the machinations that go in place to keep this modicum of a check there.
Oh, yeah. There is, like, a neoliberal part of me that, like, thinks that RB Leipzig coming in and injecting a little bit of dynamic competition into the German system has not been a bad thing for German football. You need to, like, cordon it off and prevent it from taking over the whole thing. But, like, there are problems that arise from these systems. And I think that the problem in England is that, like, there is not presently any kind of coherent demand for a power-sharing structure that might formalize the kind of... that might formalize the kind of system of accountability that fans do seem to want and be asking for.
Yeah, I was just because I think the bottom line here really is that, like, most fans are not deeply committed to wholesale change. Like, at moments of crisis, we saw a real thing. But most of the time, it's like, yeah, I don't like Kroenke, so I want him out. And I will think about the next thing when I have to think about the next thing. And, like, X seems like a dude who likes Arsenal. So, like, sure, he seems better than Kroenke. And, like, these are, like, there is no and should not be any obligation of fans to, like, invest in this more than that. But at the same time, that sort of structure of broad but relatively shallow emotional investment in how things are run, which is, like, super normal for, like, human beings, is what makes sports so, like, ripe for the kind of takeover that has happened when there were billions to be made. And because now you're just sort of in a system where, like, the people who have enough money to buy clubs are only people who are going to be buying clubs to make money or do soft power if they happen to be a country. Like, I mean, like, that's what we're, like, looking at here. There is, I mean, I think the thing I said on Twitter, right, is that, like, you can always try to get a better billionaire, but the things that lead to everything that people seem to agree that they do not like about modern football will not be gone until billionaires do not want to buy clubs.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's all, like, we keep rehearsing the same arguments about, like, natural right monarchy.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I think that, like, this is one of the issues here is that, like, what fans want is, you know, different from what citizens of natural right monarchies want. like a citizen of, like, you know, the Grand Duchy of Silesia is not, like, rooting for Silesia to like, show really strong green production this quarter. Like, they want, like, their family to be happy, and that produces a potential for political solidarity that is very, very different than being a fan of a soccer club, where in many ways you really are rooting for the Grand Duchy of Silesia to have excellent grain production. You just want things to go well on the field for your team. You want the same set of things to go well that are kind of what, you know, what ownership wants. There isn't a divergent. There is a different kind of divergence in interests, which makes it very easy for fan anger at the, you know, the failure to produce the sort of feeling of community and accountability that they want to be diverted, because fans also want to win.
Well, I mean, but also, like, winning can, like, create that kind of community that people are, like looking for. Like, winning when you are at the stadium or watching the game together with a, you know, a community of people creates a much better feeling than not winning. And you can, it really does, owners can just sort of divert that desire for community into a desire to win. Because the winning creates the community in ways that the losing doesn't at the top levels.
Yeah, and so, like, it is a real structural problem for, like, any kind of ongoing protest movement that the interests of the people protesting are so easily brought back into line with the interests of the people who own the team and are not in any real way accountable to the people protesting.
Now,
It's too easy to do that,
yeah,
for me to be really hopeful that something more is going to grow out of this protest movement and, like, you know, real accountability can come to be put in place.
Now, I will say that, you know, the things that were sort of hinted at, which really, I think, like, brought the Super League project up short, of government passing laws that will change the facts on the ground. You know, I think there was, In the midst of it, there was talk that basically the government could nationalize these teams if they so chose, which who knows if that would have ever proven to be legal. But
it would have been awesome, though.
It would have been something.
So many podcasts.
Manchester United in nebulous ownership territory for a decade and a half as this thing wound its way through various courts. But the other thing that was continued to be talked about after the fact was, you know, let's make the fit and proper test a license that can be unilaterally revoked by the government at any time. And that would change things. But, like, the way that would change things is it would really reduce the value of these clubs. Like, people people who make billions of dollars and look at investing in these things would look at this and go, well, this is like a fundamentally new risk for buying this club, and I do not know, like, and when I, like, account for that risk in my modeling of its worth, it makes the club worth less to me than it would have been otherwise. So, like, you can do things that change the fact on the ground. But all of those things will, in fact, make these clubs less attractive to people or the groups that want to buy them to make money. We had Josh Robinson on last week talking about the foundation of the Premier League, which was a decision to embrace all of these things that made the possibility of football in England being big business something that could be achieved. Now the differences between England and Spain and Italy and Germany, and whether or not there are other choices that were being made in those leagues that inhibited growth, or whether there were just like not nearly as much opportunity for various reasons, is like an interesting intellectual question, but it doesn't really like change the fact that like England went out and did this because they wanted to do this as a group of owners and really as a legal regime.
Yeah, so I'm really interested to see what comes next. I'm not super duper hopeful. As I said, I think like structurally there's a lot against the fans here.
Yeah.
But something new happened, and it was like a really, and like new things can lead to other new things. And I think we should be very modest in like what our ability to predict this is.
Yeah, I mean, I do think there is something unstable about this idea of like inexorable march towards bigger and bigger capitalism and the touching of the hot stove of the Super League and sort of taking an immense handful of steps back. And then there is something just sort of that is not unique to the Premier League about the valuation of these sports teams, and it is true of the biggest sports teams in the US too, is that at some point you just outstrip people's ability to buy them, and then like what is this value that we're talking about here? And if that's the case, well, these owners then, like, the value of these clubs then at that point becomes not in their valuation if you can't really sell them for that number, but rather in turning them into like cash rich properties, which is like not what soccer clubs were designed to do. And so it is, Manchester United is publicly traded at this point, so it's not really an issue to them. But like, you know.
But the Glazers also like hold all of the real stock.
I mean, yes, they do. But like, the valuation of that club is the valuation of the stock of that club that is traded. It is not like what Forbes says it is until you try to sell it, right? Like,
yeah.
That's a fundamental difference. But like beyond that, it's like American sports clubs too, like the Knicks. Like the Knicks have one of the worst owners in professional sports in James Dolan, and there's like, you know, there's like Dolan out noises every once in a while, and like he should sell the club, and people say this, and people get angry, and like the stadium is, you know, MSG is still like pretty well full, and who can, like, Jim Dolan doesn't really care if it's not because it's his club, but like the question always comes down to like who has the money to buy the Knicks, and the answer is nobody, and like I don't know what happens then.
Yeah, I mean, this is a thing with the Daniel Ek ownership group,
right?
Is that Daniel Ek, unless he wants to like divest himself of Spotify,
which he has said he does not,
and become someone whose entire business holdings are Arsenal Football Club, would need to be the lead of a consortium.
Right.
And so this is at this level, the sort of the whole idea of a community minded wealthy person who wants to maintain as a trust a football club kind of goes out the window unless you have a community minded consortium. And that becomes a really difficult thing to put together. Like, so I think that that's at the very top level, that's a real instability in the system.
Yes.
That like the thing the fans want is not actually really possible.
Right. It's just been priced out. Like there is no way around that. And like, we're kind of beyond like even like super rich dude comes in and is that like,
The only American who has, like, legitimately, as an individual, bought a major sports team recently is Steve Ballmer.
Yep.
Who is, like, there are, like, you know, 8 Steve Ballmers. Like this is, he right. is so much richer than Daniel Ek, who is a billionaire.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, there's, like, there's just no way around it. There's, like, you know. And I would also add that, like, these guys who are that rich, like, life events can change that richness really, really quickly, I say, on a day when it was announced that Bill and Melinda Gates are getting divorced. And, like, this is not, this happened to Monaco. I'm blanking on the Russian guy's name who owned Monaco. But he was, like, the richest guy in the world for a while, got a divorce, lost half his assets, and, like, didn't have any interest in letting Monaco be a sinkhole anymore.
Yep. Or, like, you know, something can happen to the world economy and suddenly Gillette and Hicks aren't rich anymore.
Well, I mean, this is of course, the actual story of the Glazers, right? Which is that they did a leveraged buyout to buy United. And, like, leveraged buyout is where you borrow money to buy an asset. And then the money that you've borrowed, you hang on the asset you've bought. So it is that asset's responsibility to pay it off. And you, as an owner, don't own. Right, like that's like the very short and dirty version of a leverage buyout. And like this would have been a mild drag on Manchester United's growth, except that the world economy imploded like a year and a half later. And then it was like a major sinkhole on United's growth for a decade.
And given no system of accountability, given the fact the Glazers just don't care personally anyway, they just accepted that that was the cost.
Right, that's right. And, like, for a while, they were able to be successful on the field because they had Sir Alex Ferguson, who was continuing to win anyway, but then he retired and they couldn't. And, like,
yeah,
it takes a long time to recover from that.
Yeah, so I think we have identified a set of contradictions in the system,
yes,
which will lead inexorably to its overturning.
Or you might say we have a thesis and there is perhaps an antithesis.
I love this podcast.
We are really in fine form tonight.
All right. Well, I think we've gotten where we're going to go. We were going to be coming back to this story because I really hope that it continues to be a story. And I think that, like, certainly over time it will. Exactly what happens with this protest movement is, I think, really, really unclear at this moment, and whether we just sort of had one big exciting thing or not, we'll see. And we'll be talking about the Champions League, and we will be, you know, saying who did a good corner and who did a bad corner, and that's going to be our job.
Because I love doing that. Like, I do, we both do, and we've done it for, like, years at this point. We really are invested in, like, who is good at soccer and who is not, as, like, a thing. It's just that, like, sometimes other stuff happens. We like that, too. And that makes us weird.
And that makes you weird for listening. We love you.
We do. Cheers, y'all.
Cheers.